Thank you, and thank you, Arye, for the invitation to this workshop. I was originally going to talk about two different techniques for handling oscillations in classical electrodynamics, but I found that there was more than enough to say about one of them, bond length constraints. And basically, my purpose is to derive the model in which we constrain the oscillatory degrees of freedom in such a way that is apparent what the approximations are, and also to see ways in which we can improve the approximation. This was completed at the last minute. Also, I have the habit of sometimes leaving out important things, and therefore I welcome questions during the talk for the purpose of clarification. So, classical molecular dynamics is described as a solution of a system of Hamiltonian equations. The Hamiltonian is a separable one consisting of a potential energy function and a kinetic energy part. And for molecular dynamics, it happens that some of the terms in the potential energy function are oscillatory. They can be isolated from the other terms, and they can be expressed as a function of interatomic distances, d1, d2 through dm. So m is the number of such distances. And so these are pairwise distances between atoms, and they include bond stretching terms between atoms, also the angle bending terms that involve three atoms but can be expressed as pairwise distances. And these terms can contribute frequencies as high as 110 vibrations per picosecond, whereas the terms due to the non-bonded interactions, these involve interatomic distances which can vary very greatly, and which generally don't oscillate, but can oscillate. And these have oscillations whose frequencies are only as high as 26 fluctuations per picosecond. And so we have a ratio here of 4 to 1. And so the hope is that one could increase the time step and the efficiency almost by a factor of 4, which might not seem dramatic, but given the very high cost of electrodynamics and the relatively low cost of imposing constraints, this in fact is a big win. In practice, though, only a factor of 2 is achieved, because in practice only some of these constraints are enforced, and this I'll mention more later. Now, the oscillatory part is highly nonlinear in the sense that if we were to compute or look at the Hessian of the oscillatory part, it would not be a nearly constant matrix, but rather it's a matrix which has 3x3 blocks in it, and those 3x3 blocks have the form given there. And these are distances, or these are vectors between pairs of atoms, and pairs of atoms can be engaged in rotations. And they're not necessarily a uniform rotation, but they can rotate independently of each other. So that's one of the problems, the high nonlinearity. Another one is that the non-oscillatory part can sometimes have terms which are very rapidly varying with respect to distances, so they can sometimes be large. Now, before one attempts to do approximations, it's important to ask how are we measuring the accuracy of the solution? What is it that we want to compute? And there are two things that complicate this for molecular dynamics. The first is that these systems are highly chaotic, and we can get accurate trajectories for a period of time that's equivalent to about 1,000 oscillations. Whereas types of simulations that are run, at least for biomolecules, run for about typically 1 million oscillations. So 99.9% of the trajectory is false. Well, I should say that what I'm about to say holds for Hamiltonians in general, not just both coming from molecular men, or at least the methods I'm about to describe. The other complication is that we know very little about the initial conditions. We know very little about the microscale of the system. We just have a little bit of information. And so it's mostly unknown, and so it's chosen from at random from some prescribed probability distribution. In fact, it's the second condition that saves us from the first. Because of the second condition, the questions we ask have to be less precise. And for that reason, we can then cope with the chaos from the first. So given that the dynamics is highly chaotic, we might ask, well, what can be computed? Clearly, we cannot expect to compute a trajectory accurate for a long-time simulation. But for shorter simulations, we can get accurate trajectories. And maybe for a little bit longer, we can get trajectories, although they may not accurately match the initial condition, they can nonetheless be shadowed by an analytical solution of the Hamiltonian system. And in some applications, particularly in material science, it seems that people are interested in relatively short simulations. And so, if this is the kind of problem you're interested in, then your accuracy criterion might be, for example, that the numerical solution you compute should be shadowable. On the other hand, for biomolecules, most things of biological interest do not occur in such short timescales. And so, for such applications, there are two things which I believe we can compute. One is time averages, some observables. Generally speaking, these observables are only functions of position and not functions of momentum, but at times in this talk, I'll be more general than I have to be. Oh, I didn't mention this, but in the Hamiltonian I gave to you on the second slide, there was this mass matrix, and it was given as a function of positions. If we're working in Cartesian coordinates, this mass matrix is constant. But if we do a change of coordinates, it might be dependent on position. So I just put it in there for generality. So we have some observable here, and I believe we can actually compute a time average of that, even though the trajectory is not right. And also I believe we can compute time correlation functions accurately. Right. And so to describe time correlation functions, I have to introduce this mapping, the flow, D sub T is the position of the trajectory at time T given initial conditions X and P. And for a Hamiltonian system, there will exist invariant measures. If energy is the only conserved quantity, these invariant measures will necessarily have to be functions of the Hamiltonian. And so we'll let rho be a probability density, which is invariant for the Hamiltonian dynamics. Typically, this is the Boltzmann-Gibbs distribution. And a time correlation function, then, is defined to be an average over all points in phase space, of the value of an observable at time t times the value of some other observable b at time zero. And it's conjecture of mine that apart from these two things, nothing else can be computed for long time trajectories. Now, I'm not sure whether these problems belong in this conference, because although they are highly oscillatory, they are also stiff oscillatory. Now, it's been suggested that stiff oscillatory is an oxymoron, because if we have a purely oscillatory problem, then there's no damping. And so, typically in stiff problems, we expect that certain modes will damp out, and therefore they don't have to be resolved any longer, whereas this does not happen for oscillatory problems. However, oh, and it's also ironic that the word stiff was originally used to describe purely oscillatory problems, because stiff comes from the idea of a spring being stiff and having a high frequency. However, it is the case that if we have a vibrating oscillator, that the energy will be proportional to the amplitude. And if we have a limited amount of energy and we have a spring that's very stiff, then its amplitude will be very small and therefore negligible. And so we can therefore say, indeed, we do have peerless Satori problems can be stiff if the spring constant is very high. Now, it's a little bit more difficult to argue that this would be the case if we have a large number of oscillators, because it could happen that all the energy gets concentrated into a single oscillator, and therefore its amplitude might not any longer be negligible. However, the probability of this happening is very small. It becomes exponentially small as a function of the amplitude. And so if we want to be practical, we would ignore possibilities whose probability is very small. And if we're worried about this, we can always build tests into our algorithm to make sure that the assumptions we make are correct. Now, since these problems are stiff, one might think, well, why don't we use an implicit integrator? They are so effective for most stiff problems. But there are two problems with using implicit methods, apart from the cost. But the cost, I don't think, is the real issue. The real issue has to do with approximation. One is, by doing an analysis, you can actually examine why implicit integrators are stable for oscillatory problems. They are stable because they reduce the highest frequencies to less than 1/2 per step. And so what happens when you reduce the frequencies? Well, you increase the amplitude, and so these components that no longer that were initially negligible will become less negligible if we use an implicit integrator. Another thing is that the frequencies, they become compressed, the range becomes compressed, and the separation becomes less, and this increases the coupling between the different modes. And this is likely also have introduce artifacts. And so implicit integrator is not the answer apart from the cost issue. A better approach is to completely eliminate the high frequencies, is to use constrained dynamics. Is to identify the fast variables and to freeze them at their equilibrium value. So in the particular formulation I gave of the potential energy function, I've identified this part, the oscillatory part, which is a function of distances. And we can find the minimum of that, and we can freeze the distances at the minimum. For convenience, though, it would be nice to work with fast variables whose equilibrium value was zero. So instead of using d of x to represent the fast variables, we'll use d of x minus its equilibrium value, and we'll call that g of x, which is the usual notation used for the constraint of a constrained Hamiltonian system. And so if we want to do Hamiltonian dynamics and freeze the g values to zero, we have to introduce forces by means of Lagrange multipliers, the constraint forces, in order to stay on the curve g of x equals zero. And also, as is well known, if we constrain the positions, we're also going to constrain the momenta, and so they'll have to satisfy these hidden constraints given in parentheses at the bottom there. So this is a typical method used in molecular dynamics, popular. With the use of this device, we can increase the step size by a factor of about 2. The extra cost of solving these constraint equations, it turns out to be a system of nonlinear equations, but it's only quadratic in the unknown. The additional cost is about 10%, and so this is more than compensated by the ability to double the step size. However, there are concerns about the accuracy of simply imposing constraints. And these appeared in the literature long ago. The time averages are inaccurate, and it introduces too much rigidity into the system. That is, there are occasionally large forces due to the bumping of one atom against another, and these are large enough to cause an angle to open up. And so this can lead to unrealistic simulations. And so for this reason, The use of constraints is restricted to bond length, and bond angles are typically allowed to vary. And so we're not fully exploiting the possibilities here. And so this was investigated a decade ago by Sebastian Reich in some pioneering but typical papers in which he introduced a method or a family of methods called soft fake. Interestingly enough, if you put soft fake into a search engine, you get very few hits. So these words are not actually ever used in any of the papers that Sebastian wrote. In addition, he proved that the use of this device gave us accurate short-time dynamics and accurate time averages. So the main part of my talk is to derive a scheme which is similar to SoftShake, but which is much easier to drive. In SoftShake, you modify both the potential energy and you modify the constraint function. In the scheme I'm about to derive, we will not modify the constraints because that was the part that was so difficult to implement, but we will doubly modify the potential energy function. So this is SoftShake simplified, and the goal is that we're given a unconstrained system, Hamiltonian system, and we want to approximate that by a reduced system, a system in which the dynamics is restricted to some manifold in phase space. So the configuration manifold is at dimension n minus m. N is the original dimension, and n is the number of constraints. And so we introduce our fast variables. Eta is equal to g of x. They oscillate about eta equals 0. And we introduce some slow variables by some formula to be determined. And so this gives us a transformation from the original coordinates to the new coordinates. And we also have the inverse of this transformation, which will be denoted by capital X. Now, one of the things we do not want to do is we do not want to explicitly change coordinates. And this talk would be twice as simple if it weren't for the fact that we are very concerned about this, and we want to end up with a formulation that in no way involves this coordinate transformation big X, in no way involves an explicit formula for the flow variable. The only thing that we're going to use is the g of x function and the mass matrix, which will generally be constant. Okay, so we have to make some approximations in deriving the reduced dynamics, and I think the most severe approximation is that we're going to ask for a reduced system which is deterministic. It has no stochastic term. And if we want to do dynamics for a long time deterministically and get reasonable approximations to the correct phase space densities, then it seems to me that we have to do dynamics which is Hamiltonian or some transformation of Hamiltonian dynamics. So we're going to try to seek a Hamiltonian system on the manifold of reduced dimensions. So for that reason, we're going to do a transformation of the momenta, which will give us a symplectic transformation from the original variables to the new set of variables. And it's well known then that such a transformation is a linear transformation, linear in the momenta, and is given by the formula here. This is, again, all theoretical. Very few of these quantities will actually appear in the algorithm. And if we do this transformation, we then have a new Hamiltonian, k. K of the new set of variables. Xi is the slow position, eta is the fast position, nu is the slow momenta, and pi is the fast momenta. And they are defined in terms of the original Hamiltonian and the transformations from the new variables to the original variables. And so this Hamiltonian will describe the dynamics of the new set of variables. Okay, I've put off the question of how to define the flow variables. And we're going to define slow variables in such a way that the so far we've been worrying about the manifold in configuration space, but we also have to worry about the entire phase space, so we have to worry about both the positions and the momenta. And what we would like is we'd like the corresponding manifold that describes where the momenta have to be represented by pi equals zero. So we'd like pi equals zero to be the the hidden constraint, okay? So the goal is that pi equals zero should be the hidden constraint. And so that will determine how we define the slow variables so that we get this mapping correct. And it can be shown that if this is the condition we want, that the manifold have a simple description in the new variables, then it can be shown that this is equivalent to the following condition, namely that the partial derivative of the transformation with respect to the fast variables has to be equal to that formula there. And so we can do the construction of the new variables by first specifying parameterization of the manifold in configuration space by this function x naught of psi, and then we can integrate off of the manifold for non-zero fast variables, eta, by the differential equation at the bottom there, and this way we can automatically define coordinates for the entire phase space. So anyways, the bottom line is that we have a new set of variables, and the manifold in which we want to do the dynamics is equivalent to setting eta equals zero and pi equals zero. Let's see. There we go. So in the end, we've done the transformation such that this then is the manifold in which we want to do the dynamics. And therefore, recall that, in an earlier slide, I gave the formula for the transformed fast momenta to be this in order for the transformation to be canonical. And if we satisfy the condition on the previous slide, then we have a formula. So we have an explicit formula in terms of quantities that are readily computable for the fast momenta and for the fast variables. Whereas for the slow variables and the slow momenta, we do not have a formula that is readily computable. Okay, so that desirable property. So then, given that we're doing deterministic dynamics, how are we going to match the dynamics of the reduced system to that of the original system? Well, we could ask that time averages are exactly reproduced for any observable which doesn't depend upon the fast variable. And it turns out that condition would uniquely determine what our reduced dynamics should be. We would have no more freedom left. Simply asking for exact time averages completely specifies what the reduced dynamics should be. And so one might wonder, could we do any better than to exactly match time averages? Possibly not. So exactly reproducing time averages correctly is equivalent to the reduced Hamiltonian giving the same microcanonical ensemble averages as the original Hamiltonian. That is, if we do an average of some observable on a shell of infinitesimal thickness of constant energy, will that be the same for the reduced Hamiltonian as is for the original one? It's not very easy to do analysis for the microcanonical ensemble, although some things can be done. It's much easier to work with the canonical ensemble. And in the thermodynamic limit, as when the dimension of the system gets large, averages in the Marcus canonical ensemble approach those in the canonical ensemble. The difference between them diminishes as 1 over the square root of n. And so instead what we'll ask is we'll ask that probabilities measured in the Olson-Gibbs distribution should match between the original Hamiltonian and the reduced one. So what we're doing here is we are marginalizing the fast degrees of freedom. We're asking that this just be the marginal probability of the original one for the canonical ensemble. Okay, so this is actually, well, very much investigated idea. Functions like this are called free energy, potentials of mean force, free energy profiles. And so the goal is then simply to compute this double integral here. And so conceptually, this is a fairly simple process. What makes it complicated is the desire to get an answer that depends only on things we're willing to compute and to avoid actually explicitly doing these transformations. So we want to do everything in terms of the original variables. The reason we want to do that is because what we're going to do, as I said, the basic idea is simple. Basically, we're going to take the original Hamiltonian, and we're going to tailor expand in the fast variables. Then we're going to integrate the results analytically, and that'll be our answer. But there is the concern that we'll come up with quantities which are unknown, which are not practical to use. And so what we want to know is that the coefficients in the expansion that we get make use only of numerical values of positions and momenta in the original coordinates. And that the coefficients have formulas that only involve the constraint function and the mass matrix if it's position dependent. And they're derivatives with respect to x. So those are the rules. And a necessary condition that we be able to do this is that so we're going to do expansions with respect to eta and with respect to pi. So we want the derivatives of these quantities with respect to eta and pi. They should have formulas that obey those rules there. That's a necessary condition. And this also ends up being sufficient. So those partial derivatives are part of the Jacobian matrix of the transformation. So what we have over here is the transformation from the new coordinates to the old coordinates. This is a square matrix. It's a Jacobian matrix of that transformation. What we have here is the inverse transformation, the transformation from the original coordinates to the new coordinates. And there's this inverse, and it's known that the inverse of the Jacobian is the Jacobian of the inverse for coordinate transformations. These dots indicate functions that I'd rather not name because I try to limit the number of symbols I use. But they are quantities we actually don't want to use because they involve the definition of the slow positions and the slow momenta for which we do not want to derive formulas. Now, this Jacobian matrix is a Jacobian matrix of a symplectic map. And therefore, it's a symplectic matrix. And its inverse is easy to compute. We simply perform a similarity transformation on the transpose of the matrix, the similarity transformation performed with the structure matrix. And so what we get then is this here. In other words, for that equality, we can now read off what the partial derivative of that is and that and that, and we can see that they involve quantities that we are willing to compute. Involved quantities only involved in the g function and its derivative. Now, to do the Taylor expansion, we'll be taking derivatives of arbitrary or all kinds of functions with respect to eta and pi. And, that will be done by the chain rule. And these functions will be functions of the original variables x and p. And so we're going to introduce this operator, nabla eta, should be regarded symbolically, because this will be an operator on a function of the original variables, and it will be defined this way. And so what this indicates is that we can take derivatives with respect to eta, and the result will be just functions of the original variables x and p. And the same thing can be done with respect to partial derivatives with respect to pi. They're simpler. So I didn't introduce a special symbol for the derivative with respect to pi, but it just involves taking the derivative with respect to p and multiplying by this function of x. Hence, the result of differentiating with respect to pi and eta can, as I said, be represented as a function just of positions and momentum in the original coordinates, together with formulas that only involve the g function and its derivative. And so we can do this Taylor expansion. We can carry out this exercise I mentioned before, and we can get a formula then for the marginalized Hamiltonian, which is computable. So let's do that. Let's do that in two steps. Let's do that first with respect to the fast momenta, and then with respect to the fast positions. Now, it turns out that the Hamiltonian depends in a very simple way on the momenta. It's a quadratic function of the momenta, and in fact, it's just the Hamiltonian with the momenta state equals zero plus this term here. And so we can then stick this into, we have to do two integrations. We'll do one at a time. We'll do the first integration just with respect to the fast momenta, and we'll get an intermediate Hamiltonian that depends upon the fast positions but not the fast momenta. So we have to do this integral, so we plug that into there. The only dependence on pi is there and there. We can do this analytically by doing a coordinate transformation. The coordinate transformation gives us this Jacobian. And so we have a formula here. And we can rewrite this as the exponential minus, I never did say what the beta was. The beta is the inverse temperature. And so we can reincorporate this into the potential, and so we get this formula. So this is the Hamiltonian marginalized with respect to the fast momenta. And so we have the original Hamiltonian, plus we have this additional term here. And as I said, we can rewrite this in terms of the original variables, the original x's and p's. And if we do that, we can do it this way. This says that we can write this as a function of the x and the p. This function we'll call h bar. So h bar is sort of an intermediate form of this, but in terms of the x and p variables. And h bar has this expression here. And so the second term here is the Fixman potential. It's the extra term that we have to include because we've marginalized the fast momenta. Okay, we have to do one more step. We also have to marginalize with respect to the fast positions. We have to perform an integral for those. And so that won't be as easy. And in fact, it might not even be a good approximation, except for the fact that we have this small parameter. Well, we didn't have it until now, but let me introduce the small parameter. So we have this this oscillatory part of the Hamiltonian, and it is fast compared to the rest of the Hamiltonian. And what we can do is we can imagine approximate it by quadratic at the equilibrium point. And so this term here just represents a quadratic approximation to the oscillatory part of the Hamiltonian. And there will be a little bit left over, and the little bit left over we'll throw into the first term, and we'll call that u hat. So u hat is the non-oscillatory part of the Hamiltonian plus plus a little bit left over from the oscillatory part, so that we can rewrite the oscillatory part as a purely quadratic term here. And so here we are going to use the fact that we have stiffness in the oscillatory part. And so the S-bahn here is artificially introduced, but it's introduced in such a way that that the W matrix here is of order 1. And so if we rewrite this in transformed coordinates, the new coordinates, we then get an expression like this. So we have a fast variable occurring there. And that will help us to get a good approximation to that integral. So what we want to do is we want to have a probability density that depends only on the two slow variables, and we're going to do that by integrating out the fast positions, averaging over the fast positions. And so here we are sticking in the intermediate Hamiltonian as a function of psi, eta, nu, and we've split that into two parts. And here's the stiff part, and there's the parameter epsilon. And so this is a dominant part, and so what we do is we do a change of variables. And if we do a change of variables for the eta and we get an eta prime, we can make this simpler so the integration is easier. So after change of variables, this becomes just a term like that. And this introduces an epsilon into the remaining part of the Hamiltonian. And now we can see how we can expand in powers of epsilon. We simply expand this in powers of epsilon, and we get an integrand which can be analytically integrated because we know the moments of the Gaussian. And we have, and that involves taking derivatives with respect to eta. So we have to do the expansion, we have to take partial derivatives with respect to eta, and that's why we were so worried about what that would do to our expressions. And so we can do that. And so this part of the calculation I will omit. And indicate what the answer is, at least what the first two terms are. So the K double primes will be equal to, at least formally, assuming we carry this expansion out to infinity, to some H tilde. And H tilde, which is the final reduced function that we're looking for. It only has two arguments. H tilde is the one that corresponds to the Hamiltonian with two arguments. And that would be defined in terms of the H bar, which was defined, right down here. Just the Hamiltonian to which we've added the fixedness potential. So the H tilde has this expansion in even powers of epsilon. I'm just showing you the first two powers, epsilon to the power 0, epsilon squared, epsilon to the fourth, and so on. And so this is the original Hamiltonian with the fixedness potential. And this then involves higher derivatives of that Hamiltonian using this operator, this Nabla eta operator. And these are scalar quantities here. And so in principle, this is doable. In practice, this might lead to a function which is not so cheap to evaluate. So Sebastian in his work, his approach was a little different, but basically I think he looked only at this term, and he only probably looked at the dominant part of this Hamiltonian here and included that in here. Okay, so what do we have then? We have a Hamiltonian for the reduced system, but for the reduced system in the transform variables. So we have a Hamiltonian that can be expressed as a Hamiltonian H tilde, which can be expressed in terms of X and P on the manifold. And it defines the reduced dynamics of the slow variables, xi and nu. But we don't want to do the dynamics of xi and nu because we don't want to develop formulas for the slow variables because that would be very complicated. We would like to work with the original variables, x and p, on the manifold. And so we can write down differential equations for x and p. Now, these differential equations will be those of a Hamiltonian, but the Hamiltonian will not be H tilde, it'll be H tilde plus. Because when we take the time derivative of x, we have to use the chain rule. And so we'll have to take the derivative of x with respect to xi, and then the derivative of xi with respect to t. And so that will introduce additional terms. And so the Hamiltonian that is gives rise to the dynamics in terms of the original variables, x and p, has this formula here. It's this one here plus this additional term, which has this formula here, which looks a little messy, but it's familiar to a number of you. Let's see. Oh, and the thing about this is, you could then work with this. It is easy to show that if the initial conditions are on the manifold, then the solution to the Hamiltonian system defined by this Hamiltonian will remain on the manifold. However, if you implement this numerically, it will drift off of the manifold. And therefore, computationally, this form of the Hamiltonian, or it is not desirable to work with the Hamiltonian system, with an unconstrained Hamiltonian system, but rather it is known that that Hamiltonian system is equivalent to a constrained Hamiltonian system, in which we don't have that extra term, but instead we do constrained Hamiltonian dynamics, as shown in the, slide near the beginning. And so the only difference between this and what I showed you at the beginning is now we have an improved Hamiltonian, a Hamiltonian that includes a fixed potential plus terms of order epsilon squared. And of course, in practice, you wouldn't complete them in fullness, but you would just pick up the dominant parts of those that give rise to large excluded volume forces. And you would include them. And then this would then should give you realistic dynamics on the manifold. So this is where I got to last night, Tim. And so that concludes my talk. Thanks for your attention.
You start with H in a separable form instead of starting with a problem with M of X. Does this H tilde here, do you get a separable Hamiltonian system plus constraint?
I believe the answer is no. Is that right? Yes.
Well, in my case, it was still separable.
Was it really? Because, a lot of, there's a lot of things in an operator that involves this gx. It's like doing a change of variable.
In the transform variable.
Well, even the Fixman potential. Let's look at that. Where is that? It was in green, wasn't it? Somewhere? Yeah, there is. Even if M is independent of X here, that doesn't...
Oh, that depends on position.
So that only depends on position. So we're okay there. So I haven't worked that out, but I think, unfortunately, I think the answer is that it's not separable. But in your case, you incorporate into the constraints, right? So you weren't faced with that problem. But you're faced with other problems.
I think that I recall correctly. I mean, I had two versions, right, where I changed the constraints, and then I had a version where I actually left the constraints and changed the potential.
Oh. Well, like what you do. Okay. All right. So this might be very similar to what you were doing then.
But I only included what we probably would call the dominant term. I mean, if you have a collision, then it bends.
So that could be the key. We could probably throw away those terms that involve momentum mixed with position.
Well, in case somebody makes the wrong choice of fast variables, what will happen? So when eta, it seems a modeling issue to choose eta, the eta variables or the G constraint.
Yeah.
And now imagine somebody makes the wrong decision. So what will you get from these computations? Will it be obviously wrong, or can it be mistaken for a meaningful solution?
So we did the expansion in the fast variables. And even if that wasn't so fast, but if it were quadratic, that is harmonic, then I think that the error would not be serious.
In a sense.
Oh, yeah, but there's another thing. There's an assumption that the observable was independent of the fast variables. So if the observable is independent of the fast variables, and if the so-called fast variable was slow but harmonic, then there would be no problem.
So this method is sort of safe against modeling errors.
It's somewhat safe, but if it were very non-harmonic in the slow variable, then that would be a serious problem.
Mm-hmm. And could the user detect this problem, see it somehow?
Okay, so in a method I proposed, one ahead of time identifies what these are, the fast variables. So could the user... Oh, yes, you could. Let's see. We have explicit formulas. No, of course, we're constraining them, aren't we? So that's an interesting question, whether you could detect whether one of these fast variables wishes to dramatically change in value. That's an interesting question, because that shows that the approximation at that point is broken down. Mm-hmm. And I guess you could always go to higher resistance with respect to eta. to detect these, I thought.
Well, because this seems to be a relevant issue. In some systems, it might not be easy to tell which is a fast.
Right. For what I specifically proposed here, though, it is pretty safe, that choice of fast variable. But you could go beyond angles and bond lengths. You could say hydrogen bonds are also constraints, in which case then you would indeed have that danger if the hydrogen bond were to break.
Mm-hmm. Are you thinking of doing this really for, like, if you have long polymers that you really reduce it to torsion dynamics?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what you were thinking too.
Right? Yes.
Questions. So let's thank Bob again.